overcast skies.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And these are the opening notes of what may be the most distinctive piano recording ever pressed into vinyl. It's the opening of Bach's Goldberg Variations, performed by the Canadian pianist Glenn Gould, almost 50 years ago. Gould, at the time, 22 years old. You can still buy the recording. It still sells. Gramophone magazine rates it as one of the finest albums of the last 100 years. Gould always got reverent reviews, despite his own irreverence. He once dismissed this recording himself as the most overrated keyboard disc of all time. Glenn Gould rarely recorded the same music twice, but he did perform the Goldberg Variations again, 26 years later, near the end of his short life. In fact, Gould died 20 years ago this week, and it's those two distinctive recordings we'll be talking about today. Connection listeners, what is it about Gould's treatment of the Goldberg Variations? What is it? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today is Tim Page. Tim is a Pulitzer Prize-winning music journalist, critic for The Washington Post, and a consultant on a just-released CD with both versions of the Goldberg Variations by Glenn Gould. Tim, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, the question to you first. What is it about Gould's performance of the Goldberg?
Well, I think it's a fascinating story. I mean, there's the eeriness that his first recording for Columbia Masterworks was the Goldberg Variations, and then the last recording issued during his lifetime after something like 70 other recordings was also the Goldberg Variations. So you really have Alpha and Omega, first and last. I think what was extraordinary about the first performance was the fact that he took what had been often and wrongly written off as a mere theoretical exercise by Johann Sebastian Bach and managed to turn it into one of the most exciting, propulsive, swooning, romantic, charged. I mean, you can come up with as many descriptions as there are descriptions available. And he managed to turn it into an absolute bestseller, this work which had previously been quite obscure. I mean, well-known and well-respected among musicians, but really certainly not a crowd-pleaser by any means. And it was a whole new way of playing Bach. It was not bejeweled and romanticized as so much Bach on the piano had been, and it was also not dry and detached in the way that much performance of Bach on the harpsichord had been. It was instead very much pianistic Bach, but a new sort of romping and exultant way of approaching the music.
I wonder if we can listen to an example of that, Tim, because what you're talking about, the earlier interpretations and followed by Gould. Let's listen to a very highly regarded recording of the Goldberg Variations by someone who preceded him. This is Wanda Ladowska. Okay, we're going to bring that down right now, and for comparison purposes, just go straight, if we can, to Glenn Gould's interpretation on the piano of the same piece of music. Tim Page, you called it urgent, vibrant, strutting, downright sexy, words that you don't often use to describe a pianist performance.
Well, I guess I'd stand by those words. What strikes me about the Landowska recording, marvelous though it is that it's very beautiful and very stately, but it's so didactic and so cautious and so careful. And here's Gould now racing like the wind, just playing as fast as he can, just exulting in his own powers. It's a very different way of approaching Bach. And the purists and the musicologists can argue about whether Bach should be played on the piano. There is some evidence that Bach did indeed encounter an early version of the piano late in his life. But there's no doubt that it works rather wonderfully on the piano. And for many people, Gould's first recording really came as an eye-opener.
And that one performance in Washington, January 1955, I think it was. I mean, it's regarded today as, I mean, a showstopper. So a point where people went, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And then he repeated the performance in New York about a week later. On the basis of one single performance, David Oppenheim, who was then the head of Columbia Masterworks Classical Division, signed him to a recording contract. And I can just imagine the horror that probably went through the minds of some of the people at Columbia when he said, for my first recording, I want to do the Goldberg Variations. I mean, no Chopin, no Rachmaninoff, no Tchaikovsky, and not even famous Bach, the Goldberg Variations. But Gould knew what he was doing, and the recording went into the catalog, and it has been in print now for 46 straight years. It's been out on vinyl, on cassette, on 8-track, rechanneled for stereo, on CD, in digital sound, and it's really extraordinary. I really wonder how many recordings have remained in print for that long a time.
I shudder to think of the 8-track of the Goldberg Variations.
I can remember it, a little ka-chunk here and there.
Now, I mentioned earlier in the program, and I should mention again today, that you were a consultant on a new 3-CD set that's out that has the original 55 recording, the subsequent 1981 recording, and then a large piece of an interview that you did with Glenn Gould in Toronto in the summer of 1982. And I want to talk to you about it, Tim, but first perhaps let's listen to a little bit of that exchange, because it picks up what we were talking about, the difference between playing on piano something that was written for harpsichord. This is August 1982, Tim Page and Glenn Gould.
As far as the question of whether it's appropriate to play this music on the piano is concerned, I think one has to remember that here was a man, Bach, who was himself one of the great transcribers of all time, a man who took Marcello's Oboe Concerto, for example, and made a solo harpsichord piece out of it. I've recently recorded it, so it's on my mind. Who rewrote his own violin concertos for the harpsichord, or vice versa. Who rewrote his harpsichord concertos for the organ. The list just goes on and on. Who wrote, as his masterpiece, I think, The Art of the Fugue, and gave us music that works on a harpsichord, on an organ, with a string quartet, with a string orchestra, he didn't specify, certainly, with a woodwind quartet or quintet, with a brass quartet. It works astonishingly well with a saxophone quartet. I heard it once that way.
No kidding.
Yep.
No kidding.
I just think that all the evidence suggests that Bach didn't give a hoot about specific sonority or even volume, but I think he did care to an almost fanatic degree about the integrity of his structures, I think he would have been delighted by any sound that was born out of a respect for the necessity, the abstract necessity of those structures, and appalled, amused maybe, but appalled nonetheless, by any sound that was born out of the notion that by glossing over those structures, it could improve upon them in some way. I don't think he cared whether the B minor mass was sung by 16 or 160. I think he cared how they sang it.
Tim Page, when that was recorded, there's a story behind that, because you weren't just
sitting there chatting.
There's
a story behind it. No, there's a long story about it. If you have time, I'll go a little bit into the philosophy behind bringing out this set. Can we go into that now?
Yeah, sure. I'd like to hear about it.
Well, the idea was that we would issue the 55 Goldberg Variations and clean up the sound a little, although the sound was pretty good and remains pretty good. The main thing that we wanted to do when we were listening to this set was the 1981 version was recorded in digital sound, and it was the very early days of digital. And so The recording was wonderful, and the performance was wonderful, but the actual sound seemed to many of us rather artificial and just really not an ideal piano sound. And what we found was that as a safety backup, the 1981 recording had also been recorded in what was then the standard way of recording, analog sound. And we went back to the analog tapes and brought them out for the first time.
God, so those bless who have the engineers owned, for keeping those, right?
Exactly. Absolutely. Now, as for our crazy little quote-unquote spontaneous interview, there is a story. There were three ways to interview Glenn Gould. There was the way that I first came to know him, working for a what was then called an underground newspaper in New York called the Soho Weekly News, where I actually just got on the phone and talked with them all night about a number of things. And we had, in that case, a very spontaneous conversation about all sorts of shared interests and shared likes and dislikes, which I later turned into a print interview that concludes my book of The Glenn Gould Reader. After that, another way of interviewing Glenn Gould was to send him questions over radio, which I did when I was working at WNYC, and then he would send back answers. So you'd have to do something like, we asked Glenn Gould whether he felt that this was this.
His answers came back on tape?
His answers came back on tape, and I must say it was one of his less successful experiments because he tried to put in all sorts of ums and ahs and, well, it's a really nice day here today, Tim, and I, of course, couldn't act my part. And then there's what we did in 1982. I went up to interview him to do an in-person interview, which he rarely gave, and he suggested that I could help him with a radio performance of the Goldberg Variations. So he sent me a tape of the new performance. I wrote down a lot of notes and sent back my thoughts. He took my thoughts and then wrote a script with some of my thoughts and, of course, some of his own thoughts, some of the things he wanted to do, and then sent me back the script. And then I okayed the script and made some changes. And then I came to Toronto, and we recorded this as a radio drama. In short, I was basically a character named Tim Page playing a person named Tim Page, or rather a person named Tim Page playing a character named Tim Page based on the thoughts of Tim Page and Glenn Gould.
In a way, because not inconsistent with the way he approached his music, though, because he liked that degree of control. That's why he stopped performing live.
He absolutely loved that degree of control, and it was the only way he would do a radio broadcast like this. The fact that this is now issued to, you know, a huge audience would have come as an amazing surprise to both of us. We did this really almost as a lark. We thought a few public radio stations would be playing it. I certainly planned to play it on WNYC when I got back, but it was not something that we expected would ever come out on a CD. But it was tremendous fun meeting him and putting this together, and I only wish I'd been a better actor.
And as we listen to what is variation number 3 from the 1955 recording, Connection listeners, an invitation to you to join me and Tim Page as we talk about the Goldberg Variations 20 years after the artist's death. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about the Goldberg Variations. A terrific irony was that when Bach composed the Goldberg Variations back in 1742, they were in fact a commission piece to the Russian ambassador to the Saxon court, and what he wanted them for was as music that he could fall asleep to. It was meant to be a lullaby. It was to be played by his own private musician, Gottlieb Goldberg, hence the name Goldberg Variations, as opposed to aria with different variations for harpsichord with two manuals, Bach's name for it. Now, what we've been talking about on the program was what the music writer Tim Page refers to as the Alpha and Omega recordings of the Goldberg Variations done by the Canadian pianist Glenn Gould, done first in 1955 when he was just a young man, again in 1981 in the year of his death. And I thought that what we could do is perhaps listen to a little bit of the 1955, compare that to 1981. We'll bring Tim in and talk about what he hears and the difference. So let's start with what would be, this is Variation Number 1, recorded in 1955. And from 1981, 26 years later, the same pianist, Glenn Gould, the same piece of music, the Bach-Goldberg Variations. We're listening to an older and wiser piano player there, and in the interview that you recorded on the occasion of comparing the two of you sat around and joked on paper about the stopwatch and the length of time that one runs as opposed to the other. But beyond the length of time in substantive intellectual terms, what do we hear in the difference?
Well, I think the first recording is that of a very young man, a very brilliant young man, bursting with ideas, bursting with enthusiasm and passion and just energy. The second recording is, again, a great masterpiece and, again, a great musician, but from a very, very different perspective. It is, if you like, a more calculated and less impulsive recording. Those two variations are markedly different, although I would say in some ways the second performance of that particular variation sounds almost Prokofiev-like. It's very spiky and aggressive very rhythmic, rhythmically constrained. That's not necessarily the case in a lot of the rest of the second performance. I would say that the overriding mood of the 1981 Goldbergs tends to be one of reflection, rumination, a certain gentle wisdom that has not come without a price. I think it's a much sadder performance, if people will forgive me for referring to music as happy and sad, or performances as happy and sad. I think there's a deep melancholy and a deep sense of meditation, to the second performance. They're both wonderful, and I mean, people can have arguments, and they have indeed been having arguments now for 20 years over which one is quote unquote better.
And they will
think they're
for
both
another 220 years. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, they're very different. And you know, there are actually two live performances of Gould playing the Goldberg Variations. One recorded in Toronto when he was even about 20, and another one in Salzburg, and they're quite different from these two too. So it's quite interesting.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Chris has been waiting patiently on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking the call. I can remember some 32 years ago in music school listening to the recordings of Glenn Gould as the epitome, the ideal of playing Bach. And there's a quality about them that it's like a peak experience, like what an athlete calls a peak experience, or getting into the zone, where it's almost like the music is playing the musician. It's like he transcends you know, the self, and it's just a spirit playing through him. And I wanted to share something with you, a quote from Bach on the purpose of his music. First of all, he said the object of all music should be the glory of God. And then on the meaning of the music, he says, I want to demonstrate to the world the architecture of a new and beautiful social commonwealth. Each instrument and counterpoint, and as many contrapuntal parts as there are instruments. It is the enlightened self-discipline of the various parts, each voluntarily imposing on itself the limits of its individual freedom for the well-being of the community. That is my message. Not the autocracy of a single stubborn melody on the one hand, nor the anarchy of unchecked noise on the other. No, a delicate balance between the two, an enlightened freedom, the science of my art, the art of my science, the harmony of the stars in the heavens, the yearning for brotherhood in the heart of man. This is the secret of my music.
And it was Gould who got that, right?
Yes, yes. You, right. And this this quote from Bach, I mean, this is Bach in his thinking. He was just centuries ahead of his time. This is something, you know, the eternal quality of his music. This quote was presented at an international musicians conference by the Baha'i Faith, a member of the Universal House of Justice from Haifa, Israel. And it goes along with the same, you know, principle, the unity of mankind.
Tim Page, was Gould a part of this depth of interpretation and understanding, not just of Bach's music, but of the way that his own performance of it was regarded?
Well, I'll certainly go this far. There is a sense with Gould's best Bach performances that he begins emotionally and, if you like, spiritually on a level where other people break off. I mean, right from the very start, there's just this absolute intensity. I've heard that that there was a heart surgeon who used to listen to Gould's Goldberg Variations before he would go into surgery to prepare himself, to steady his nerves, to center his thoughts. So I would definitely go along with that. And I think Glenn Gould would definitely agree with a great deal of what Bach said. He was interested not, I think the word was something like the tyranny of the single melody. With Bach and with the contrapuntal music that Gould loves so much, he loved the idea of many different voices going all at once and all adding up to a whole. And I think it's one of the amazing things about Gould's pianism is the fact that it really feels like this is a person with 10 completely distinct fingers that live their own independent little lives. The way he manages to keep so many voices going at once is much more than just a sleight of hand. It's really close to miraculous.
Hence Kathy's observation that the music is playing the musician. Or Chris's, I'm sorry. Chris, thanks so much for your call. It's nice to have you on the program. Let's dip back, if we can, Tim, into the conversation that you had with Glenn Gould, the scripted conversation. In fact, it adds kind of a delicious other level to know that he wanted that degree of control. But here are the two of you discussing the comparison of 55 and 81 versions of the Goldberg Variations.
Now, this is the 1955 version.
Which sounds remarkably like a Chopin nocturne, doesn't it?
No. I think on its own terms, though, Glenn, that this is really lovely playing.
Well, yeah, it's okay, I guess, but there's a lot of piano playing going on there, and I mean that as the most disparaging comment possible. You know, the line is being pulled every which way. There are cute little dynamic dips and tempo shifts, like that one, things that pass for expressive fervor in your average conservatory, I guess.
Do you really despise this version?
No, I don't despise it. I recognize, you know, that it's very well done of its kind. I guess I just don't happen to like its kind very much anymore. And I also recognize, to be fair, that many people will probably prefer this early version. That many people may find the new one rather stark and spare emotionally. But this variation, number 25, represents everything that I mistrust in the early version of the Goldberg. It wears its heart in its sleeve. It seems to say, please take note, this is tragedy. You know, it doesn't have the dignity to bear its suffering with a hint of quiet resignation.
And the new version does.
Well, I'm prejudiced, but I think it does, yeah.
Well, we're approaching a cadence.
Well, let's have a listen to the 25th variation from the 81 performance and see what Glenn Gould's talking about.
Thank you.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Now Willie's on the line. Hi, Willie.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me on. I was just thinking about what you were saying before about what makes Glenn Gould's performance so passionate and so special. I'm a pianist myself, and I think what Gould did and what I respect about him is that he would play from his heart. He wasn't worrying about if people liked it, if other musicians liked it. There's a lot of times, you know, you're dealing with a record company and you have to play what is going to sell records. Mm-hmm. You have to deal with what people are going to enjoy, what people are going to pay for and pay time and time again for. I think that he was just playing as an artist, and that comes through.
Playing to please himself or playing to his own standards.
Exactly. You know? Not worrying about, you know, are people going to like it? So maybe I should change it so that people will like it and buy more CDs.
It's interesting. I was reading an article that the English professor and cultural writer Edward Said had written about Glenn Gould prior to the program, Willie, and he says almost exactly the same thing that you're doing. I'll read you a line from it here. He says, "The tension in Gould's virtuosity remains unresolved. By virtue of their eccentricity, his performances make no attempt to ingratiate themselves with his listeners or reduce the distance between their lonely, ecstatic brilliance and the confusions of the everyday world."
Yeah. I mean, he also had a pretty troubled life, you know, popping pills and his own particular brand of drug abuse. And that definitely comes through in the music. I'm a jazz musician, so a lot of jazz musicians have gone through, you know, during that same time in the 50s, 60s, have gone through a lot of problems with drug abuse, and you can hear that in their music as well. I mean, just the pain of life.
Willie, thanks a lot for your call. I want to ask Tim to come in on here on those peculiarities of Glenn Gould's life. You, in dealing with him as a journalist, would have, I suppose, seen a fair amount of what made him distinct in his time, if that's not an unflattering way of describing it.
No, he was definitely distinct, and he was definitely a one of a kind. There's this sense that great geniuses are going to be, you know, regular guys, and they just aren't, almost without exception. He was somebody who was very aware that he was not only special, but special from a very early age. He was somebody who really never had a childhood in a lot of ways, because he had this need to fulfill, I think, what he would probably not use this sentimental a term, but his destiny, as it were. He also realized pretty early on that he could not really pretend to be normal. So he I think, stopped caring so much about that, because everybody said he was eccentric, everybody said he was odd, but it was also that he played magnificently well, and I think he had the courage to really go it alone. I think one of the reasons he had such a self-deprecating sense of humor was almost to deflect the bullies of the world, the ones who certainly would pick on a young boy playing the piano all the time when he was 8 or 9. And I think there were other bullies later on in life, the real bullies that you deal with just as life proceeds. And so what he did was he tried to control his environment so that people could not break his break his concentration and distract him, could not really get in and bother him. And so he really removed himself from the world in a lot of ways and was very careful about the people that he spoke with, about his recordings, because it was a part of what probably seemed a chaotic and rather frightening world that he could completely control.
Let's see if we can squeak in a call before we go to our next break. Lenny's on the line from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Hi, Lenny.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question for Tim on the issue of Mr. Gould's chair, and I should mention I have a bit of a personal interest in this because I also use a very small chair.
You're a pianist as well, are you, Lenny?
Yes, I am. Yeah. I, in fact, at one time hoped to study with Glenn Gould. That'll give you an idea as to how severe the thing was. I contacted him after becoming a top prize winner in the Bach competition years and years ago. I discovered that the use of the small chair enables the pianist to use a different type of approach to the keys. And actually, since Gould was attempting, as did I and as do some pianists, to integrate the notions of articulation and phrasing as well as the dynamic nuances that the piano affords, working towards this compromise, if you will, between the earlier performance of Wanda Landowska, let us say, and some of the harpsichordists who have followed in her footsteps, and what a pianist can do with that set of notes, rather than necessarily playing it, let us say, the way Rudi Serkin played Bach, which is certainly much more romantic, but not very stylistic, and in my opinion, not particularly enjoyable Bach. I wonder, because Gould, we know, had all sorts of injuries, including back injuries, which would have made it necessary for him to sit in a lower chair, and yet I wonder whether there was also a part of his choice of the chair that was really helpful because it enabled him to do things on the piano that he might not have been able to do, or at least certainly that I am not able to do, sitting in a normal chair at the piano.
I can tell you, Lenny, that revered as he is and was in Canada, the cartoonist used to take great pleasure in drawing Glenn Gould with his butt nearly on the stage and his eyes right at the line of keys. Now, we have to step away for a short break here, so we're going to listen to a little bit more of Variation number 25 from the 81 performance. And when we come back, Lenny, I'll get Tim to speak back to you about the use of the low chair and how it was explained by Glenn Gould himself. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.org.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And with me on the program today, Tim Page. He is Pulitzer Prize-winning music journalist, critic for The Washington Post, consulted on a just-released 3-CD set with both versions of the Goldberg Variations recorded by Glenn Gould in 1955 and 1981. And Tim, let's start off where we left off with Lenny's curiosity about that low chair. Did Gould talk to you about it?
Well, he talked to me a little bit about it. I've thought a bit about the chair, and I can at least add one anecdote that might be of interest. When we finished doing this interview at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was as tired as I'd ever been, I left the room for a moment and came back, and there was Glenn Gould playing the piano, singing along in the studio where we recorded the interview. And I tried to make myself wake up because I'm one of the very few people of my generation who actually heard him play live. And he played a number of things. He played some Beethoven and some Richard Strauss. And then he tried to play a little bit of the Goldberg Variations. And he says, I cannot play the Goldberg Variations or any Bach except on my chair.
Oh, and he didn't have his chair with him at the time.
No, he didn't, because we just moved to the studio late at night to make the recording. He did no playing that evening on the recording. It was all the two older performances. But he could not do Bach, and I think this is because he got a certain physical effect out of it that he found specifically helpful playing contrapuntal music. I think it allowed him perhaps a better vantage point on which to move his fingers. I will also say, though, that I think that the chair, which fell apart, you know, there's a picture on the back of the album of Gould playing, and you see this chair and all this stuffing is coming out from the middle of it. I think there was something much more psychological with that, because let's face it, the low chair could have been replaced as a physical object.
The Linus blanket, the whoopee that he had with
it. It really was, you know, because it was made by his father. He also learned to play the piano nestled in his mother's lap, which would have had him something like at the same angle that he was as a grown-up playing at the keyboard. So there was some very totemic significance to this chair for Glenn. And, you know, the chair eventually fell apart entirely, and it must have caused I would think, considerable pain to even sit on it. All the stuffing went away and it was just bare bones. But Gould still insisted upon using it any time he made a recording.
A couple of times over the course of the hour, Tim, you've referred to the contrapuntal playing of Bach, of the way that Glenn Gould took advantage of that. We have from 1967 an example of the way Gould's mind worked with the whole idea of contrapuntal. He did a radio documentary for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation set in an isolated community in northern Canada, something that was a great fondness for him. But what fascinates me about it, and we'll just listen to a portion of it here, is the way that he took a series of conversations that he had with people in that community and mixed them together the way that you might actually different parts in a piece of music.
Time the sun would set. But when there was still the last shimmer in the sky, I would walk out to one of those lakes and watch those ducks and geese just fly around peacefully or sitting on the water. And I felt that I was almost part of that country, part of that peaceful surrounding. And I wished that it would never end.
Are we right to open
the mass media, which is the
real truth for me as a nurse, because of the fact that whenever I spoke to
but where they up do on the first white man, the far north supreme,
I think people tend to go for the more
the rest of the world.
Tim, so many ways to see into that man's mind.
I can just imagine what somebody would be thinking who just tuned in and heard that in the background.
Right.
Yeah, that was the
idea
was
of the North
a trilogy
right?
wrote the idea of North.
Yeah.
Either that or the latecomers. I can't remember which one that comes from. I think it is the idea of North. And Gould thought of that as actually a trio, different ideas, all working toward a sort of idea fugue, if you like, bringing the voices up, bringing them down. And he thought of this, what he called contrapuntal radio, as a form of music in itself. I think one of the things that's very interesting about Gould, and it's interesting that people have brought up jazz in reference to Gould, I want to bring up something which I think is quite interesting about Gould, which has more to do with pop music. Gould was perhaps the first musician to absolutely renounce the stage and to make all of his recordings off by himself. But it would happen with some of the real giants in the pop world after that. I'm thinking of the Beatles, and especially Brian Wilson, who just simply withdrew from live performance and spent all of his time just working on a record with the idea that he was going to make it the fullest and most exact musical experience possible. And I think Gould was ahead of his time on that. And nowadays, of course, we listen to some of the very best pop musicians. I think of Stephen Merritt and the Magnetic Fields, and the entire 69 Love Songs 3-CD set was made in a little apartment, a one-room apartment. I think Gould has had a profound effect, I think, whether these folks know it or not, on the sort of zeitgeist that surrounds the making of a recording as a work of art in itself.
1-800-423-8255. Julie's calling us from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you? I was thrilled to hear what you played today, and it brought back a lot of memories. When I was a young kid studying piano, I heard this recording, the very first recording of Glenn Gould, and it totally blew me away. My friends at the time were all listening to Elvis, and so I was a musical sort of a nerd in their minds, and it just totally changed my life. I went on to major in music and piano at the University of Michigan.
What was it, Julie? What was it about?
The man had a feel for Bach that I've never, ever heard in another human being, at least up till that time. He had such a feel for the musician, and I felt it. You could really hear it, and I've listened to that thing thousands of times. And could not get enough of it.
Did you ever see him perform or ever meet him?
I did. I met him. I went on to University of Michigan. I was a piano major for a little bit. before I got into journalism, and I was a music critic for a while. But I heard him in concert, and I ran backstage. He was fantastic. He did not play the variations, unfortunately, but I ran back to meet him and shake his hands. And as you know, you may know, he would never take his gloves off. The man kept his hands protected when he wasn't at the piano. But I shook his gloves, and it was thrilling enough to do that. And then I finally met another person who felt the same way about him at the university there, and he was a musician also, and he turned out to be a very famous musician. He had the same feel for Bach. Believe it or not, he became a rock musician. His name was Felix Pappalardi.
Oh, sure.
He was with Mountain. His believe it or not, he was very influenced by Bach and by the Goldberg Variations and other Bach music.
Tim, you said, oh, sure, as if the type of influence that Julie is describing is really not an uncommon thing for you to hear.
Well, the extraordinary thing about Gould is that whatever music you're interested in, there's just no denying that the technical command, and more than the technical command, the musical command of Gould's playing is just dazzling in the same way that one can admire and respect many, many different types of guitarists or different types of pianists or violinists. Also, I think Gould was a fascinating figure. I mean, he was such an interesting man, this reclusive he admitted to himself and to the world his various difficulties. Never made a big deal out of him. He just thought, well, this is who I am and this is who I'm going to be. I also think that early on, Gould had that same sort of tough, tender dichotomy that we found in a lot of other 50s icons, certainly James Dean and Marlon Brando, perhaps Elvis Presley. The idea of somebody who was, on the one hand, you know, this swaggering, seemingly antisocial person who is capable of the most extraordinary tenderness in his artistry. I'm thinking of James Dean in something like Rebel Without a Cause, who he's the tough guy who goes and rides his bike and goes into this sort of automobile death bout. At the same time, he's this very complicated and almost, Easter chick-like tender person underneath it all. And Gould, in his recordings, and I think to some extent in his public persona, showed some signs of that.
There's a wonderful insight into the humor of the man, and it plays to what you were talking about a little bit earlier in his delight in being in the studio. It's one of the outtakes from the 55 recording of the Goldberg Variations. This is Glenn Gould with one of the studio engineers during a break.
You know what this piece is, don't you, this quadruplet? It's a combination of German popular songs of Bach's time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, that's why it's called quadruplet. Apparently it was the fashion that the family sat around their living rooms trying to harmonize popular tunes together within the same harmonic framework, you see. And the two tunes in this are, I've forgotten the names of the songs in German, but they're both very dirty songs. One of them goes... By the way, I have a quadruplet of my own which came to me in the bathtub the other night. One of these times I'm going to be invited to give a concert on the 4th of July, I'm sure. And when I do, I figured out that by leaving out the repeats in the Star Spangled Banner and starting your entry at the 13th bar of God Save the King, and then playing God Save the King over again, and altering the harmony in the second half of the King to modulate to the supertonic region, it has the most marvelous effect. Listen to this. I'll start from halfway through the King the first time, before the Star Spangled Letters.
Thank you.
style octaves at the end, but it works beautifully otherwise.
It's terrific.
Isn't that tremendous? I don't know why no one ever discovered it before.
You actually get to hear that on the 3CD set that's recently been released of the 55 and the 81. Tim, I listen to that and your stories and think to myself that you're privileged to have been as close to the man as you were.
I was terribly privileged. And one thing I'd like to say about Glenn is that, you know, he's so often portrayed as this sort of mopey, Bergman-esque neurotic going through life gloomily. And in fact, he was tremendous fun and very warm and very gentle and very supportive and very thoughtful. I only knew him the last couple of years of his life, but I think I did know him pretty well. And I just think he'd be so thrilled that people are still so interested in what he's doing all these years later. I only wish he'd had a chance to experience the internet, because I think he would have loved it, and I think he'd probably be sending us out new modules to download every day.
I would have kept him away from the piano, though.
Oh, no, he would have been playing the piano and sending them out.
Okay. Tim, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Tim Page, music critic for The Washington Post and a consultant on a new CD set with both the 55 and 81 versions of the Goldberg Variation by Glenn Gould. What we're listening to right now is the closing theme from 1981, so I'll be quiet so we can listen to it a little bit more. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.